session number 21281, rule 2.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, reel 2K1, stroke 2. You were saying that in the Second World War, strategic air power in support of land operations could be a double-edged weapon.
Yes, the trouble was that you got, and I remember standing actually watching it with the whole earth shaking, you get these large numbers of heavy bombers coming in and attacking the German positions at Koch, and they cause such devastation on the ground amongst the buildings and so on. The Germans, who've probably been forewarned in a number of ways that these attacks are coming in, who've moved out while the bombing took place, were able to come back into the rubble and put up a very strong defence. But now, of course, the greatest changes in technology have been with smart weapons which can be fired with the most enormous precision and go into a town, turn left at the traffic lights, and go straight down into a building that you want to knock out, or a headquarters you want to knock out. And this does mean that you can be very precise about knocking out all the German command infrastructure, the enemy infrastructure. And this was a great benefit to the ground troops, and a good example of this is the Gulf War.
Another thing about Field Marshal Montgomery's era is that he was able, as an individual, to select his own staff to a very great extent and to insist upon having certain individuals whom he knew and who he trusted and whose judgment he respected, like his chief of staff, de Gangon, who you mentioned. Did you have a similar freedom to pick and choose your staff when you were Field Marshal?
No. Certainly not. I mean, I was very, very well served, but I mean, there were so many factors taking into consideration when, in peacetime, or even in minor wartime commissions, how people were appointed, and you really would not be able to object to them unless they were completely unsuited, which was very unlikely. But Montgomery would have had none of that. He would consider it absolutely essential that he chose precisely who he wanted and put him where he wanted him. And I think that in that sort of circumstances, you've got to allow the commander to do that. There's an element of favoritism about it, of course, but if it produces efficiency, you've got to go along with it. And that would be very different today. Other people would decide who would be posted as your chief of staff or whatever it may be. And as I say, you would have to have a very good reason for objecting to it.
Another of his ways was to organise his headquarters along certain lines, and it seems that he really preferred to be as far away as possible from his main headquarters with its administrative and logistic and support staffs, in a sort of hermitage with himself and a few of his senior staff officers and his junior liaison officers, so that he could concentrate on thinking. Were you able to make similar arrangements for yourself?
Well, first of all, I think it is worth emphasising that this is one of the most important ways that important attitudes that Field Marshal Montgomery brought to the battlefield. No doubt about it at all. His determination was to be able to keep his mind absolutely clear for fighting the battle and for thinking ahead and not to get bound down in detail. So he shut himself away in a small tactical headquarters with a very small staff and a lot of liaison officers, as you said. He made the overall plan. He set totally wrong what they'd got to do, and then the chief of staff in the much larger headquarters got on with working out the details. Now that was the first thing that had not really been done before. He never got cluttered up with detail. The second thing is that in battle, information takes a long time to get back from the front to the headquarters at the top, a very long time, and often when it comes back, it is not correct. It may be that it gets confused on the way down. It may be that the frontline people are not precisely telling the truth, that they're actually doing better or worse than they are pretending they're doing. And the result was that Monty said, I'm not prepared to wait for all this thing laboriously to come up the chain of command. So he had two things at his disposal. First of all, a communications outfit called Phantom, which meant that officers and wireless sets could go to key points and get wireless traffic directly back to his headquarters instead of having to go through the chain of command. And secondly, he had these liaison officers who went out each day to various points in the front. They had the authority to talk to the commanders there, and they were able to come back and tell the commander-in-chief precisely what was happening and how the various commanders were bearing up and what their attitude was and so on. So he had this picture every evening of what was happening, which might have taken a long time to percolate if it come up. Now, we had never, certainly, we hadn't developed that system. Mind you, I was commanding a division, and I had various means of finding out myself, particularly, of course, a greater use of helicopters, which Montgomery never had. I mean, I could go to any part of my divisional area in a few minutes in a helicopter, and therefore I reckoned that I had, in that way, a better thing. So it wasn't necessary for me to have people. And I don't think the commander-in-chief, although he might have developed it once the battle had started, again, I think the difference was that you had better forms of electronic intelligence than you had in Montgomery's day, and you had helicopters, and that enabled commanders to get round the battlefield much quicker than Montgomery could.
Sir Peter Labillier says that one of the difficulties that occurred in the conduct of operations in the Gulf War was that there was too much information, that the means of acquiring information provided such an avalanche of facts that it became very difficult to discriminate between those which were important and relevant and those which were not.
Well, I'm sure he's absolutely right, and that is almost endemic in the use of computers. They tell you more than you actually need to know. And of course that would be another reason for having these high-powered liaison officers going out who could actually make a judgment on these things instead of just getting this mass of stuff, who could sort out the wood from the trees, the wheat from the chaff.
Rather like the difference between a photograph and a sketch drawn by a trained artist.
Yes, well, I suppose that is perfectly true. But, of course, photographs have got to be analysed. The sketch is presumably only doing with what you actually need to show.
In your time, during the conduct of the Falklands War, you were really rather between Montgomery's era of inadequate communication and the Gulf War of an excessive overload of information. Did you find that you got just about the right amount of information in time?
I mean, I was a chief of staff. I was not the commander-in-chief. I mean, I was the correspondent of Alan Brooke, although I'm modest enough not to make a direct comparison. I was a chief of staff. Admiral Fieldhouse was the commander-in-chief, and so he was the chap. But communications actually were, of course, far better than they were in the Second World War. And I don't just mean computers, which, as you say, can produce more than you need, but voice communications. And I happened to be down at the Commander-in-Chief's headquarters when the Battle of Goose Green was on, because I was wanting to keep in the picture from the land point of view. And I was able to listen in his headquarters in real time to the battalion command net, which was coming over satellite communications. And I heard, actually, somebody saying, Sunray, the commanding officer, is down, or we've shot down a Pekara, or whatever it is. And I was actually hearing the battle 8,000 miles away in exactly the real time that it was being fought. So, of course, communications are much better. So in that sense, you might say, well, you don't need the liaison officers. But if you were going to rely on stuff coming back up the computer chain, well, then, of course, you do.
What the liaison officers might be able to do, which computers or even very good communications can't, of course, is give an assessment of the state of mind and morale of the headquarters of a corps or divisional commander.
Undoubtedly. And I would like to emphasise that. It wasn't just lines on a map. It was, are these chaps in good heart or not good heart? Are they positive and effective, or are they rather low on morale?
When you were a young officer in 1944, did you ever meet the Field Marshal?
Yes, I met him once at a what you might call a prize giving. He presented me with a medal. And I went to his headquarters, and before I went in, the staff officer said to me, "The Field Marshal will say to you, have we met before?" And he said, "He doesn't mind you saying yes, he doesn't mind you saying no, but he does not like you saying I can't remember." I remember that well.
How did the encounter go?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of other people there too. We just, what unit, what battalion you're with, and where have you been, and, Monty liked in any conversation to bring himself into it, of course. I mean, one of the reasons he had this tremendous self-confidence was that he was a fairly egoistical person. I mean, he was, he liked to be the boss, he liked to be the centre, he liked things to revolve around him. And there's some very good stories about him, always tending to bring himself into the argument. But that, of course, that was one side of this very dynamic commander who would stand no truck, no belly aching, that was his word. He was always the boss, he was always in control. And that's why he rather liked a lot of younger people who looked up to him, round him. He could, control discussions, control. And he didn't like to be argued with very much. I think if a chap knew what he was saying and it was positive, that was all right. But, he didn't like belly aching. He didn't like people saying, "Well, I'm afraid we can't do that."
Sir Carol Mather says that on occasions when he was serving as a liaison officer in the Western Desert, when he got back in the evening to Montgomery's headquarters and had been debriefed about whatever he'd been sent out to find out, Montgomery would sometimes ask him questions about the grandest questions of strategy on the grounds that a young and uncluttered mind might have a useful new idea.
Yes, well, I'm sure he did, but I at the end of the discussion, he would say, "Well, that's very interesting, but this is what we're going to do."
He would make his own mind up.
What?
He would make his own
make
mind
his
up.
Own mind up. But no, then that's very flattering for young people. I mean, I worked subsequently for Lord Mountbatten, and he brought people in like that, what do you think? And it made you feel part of the show. It was known as the philosophy of the hive.
The philosophy of the hive?
Hive.
As though you were all bees.
Well, you were all in the,
You were all working towards the same end, actively.
Absolutely.
Did you notice how his headquarters was laid out when you went to receive your decoration from him?
Well, I don't think I went. Well, I'm sure I didn't. It was held in a school building or something like that, near where his headquarters was. I didn't go actually to the headquarters. I mean, there really wouldn't be anywhere in the headquarters to do it. I mean, his tactical headquarters was a very small place. I expect his main headquarters was in, and his tactical headquarters was practically never. In the winter, and they got to Belgium and Germany for a time, but it was practically never in buildings. The caravans were laid out. The ADCs and liaison officers slept on camp beds under tarpaulins, canopies that went out from the caravans or the signal vehicles or whatever. Very, very strange. None of them lived in buildings at all. Montgomery wouldn't have that. I mean, funny enough, the Germans, nothing wrong with the German commanders, but they always lived in the most marvellous schlosses and chateaus and things in tremendous style. But not so Montgomery. He always had this rapport with the forward troops. I mean, he was living just like them. And when he first put his headquarters ashore in Normandy, in a place called Crécy, when they moved in, there were quite a lot of Germans still in the barns round about, which I expect Colonel Mather might have talked about that. And the headquarters got shelled quite frequently.
Has the way in which work in headquarters is organised and the way in which facilities are provided changed in your time since then?
Yes, I mean, it's. I think we were touching on this before. I mean, all headquarters now are tremendously electronic. I mean, all staff officers sit behind computers, and all the maps are made on computers, and there are no sort of drawing pins and China graph pencils and things now. I mean, the whole thing is tremendously electronic, like a sort of big business. And you know, one worries about this to some extent, because you feel you've only got to get a fuse go or somewhere, and you could get a complete stagnation of the whole works. And there's no, as a soldier will say, there's no substitute for the Mark One eyeball.
Or the map with the talc on it.
Or the map with the talc on it, absolutely. And so that side of it, I mean, Montgomery would hardly recognise that. But I do remember taking Montgomery round the new set-up headquarters of the Ministry of Defence under Mountbatten, where we set up a new Chiefs of Staff room, and there were television screens and everything like that. And this is comparatively old hat, and from the Chiefs of Staff room down to the communication centre, there were great tubes so that messages could come rushing up from the tube and be put onto the thing. And Montgomery was asked to come round it, and he looked up and he said, "What's this? Marks and Spencer's?" he said.
When you were a divisional command, did you have a similar sort of arrangement to Montgomery with caravans for your command vehicles?
Yes, I did. I did have, we all had a tactical headquarters, and a small tactical headquarters at divisional level, and higher up too. And Mayen was a much bigger affair. And that got us a little bit nearer the front line, nearer the troops.
Another distinct.
But I don't think they would have done it brigade or level. They would have been in the one headquarters, and if the brigadier wanted to go out, he'd go out with a few jeeps and so on.
So it would have been a Land Rover party going out. Another thing about Montgomery was his fairly rigid adherence to a routine program of working, of going to bed always at the same time, insisting he must not be disturbed. And he's alleged to have said that the most precious time of day for him was the first half hour sitting in his bed with his mug of tea.
He was a man, a very highly organised man, and that was so. But of course, he did break that rule occasionally. I mean, the most famous occasion was in the middle of the Battle of Alamein, when there was considerable disagreement between him and one of the corps commanders, and when the army armour had prepared to have got stuck in the two corridors that were being fought. And at about 2 a.m, he called a conference with his corps commanders and so on to make his point absolutely clear, because they were saying this is not working.
Is this when he had his famous disagreement with General Lumsden?
That's right. That's absolutely right. And so that, you know, his sleep was disturbed. But in general terms, he certainly didn't want to be disturbed by little petty things which could easily wait till morning, because, I mean, he realised that an army commander is under considerable strain. I mean, don't forget that Rommel, I think, twice went ill, and was ill at the start of the... He'd gone back to Germany at the start of the Battle of Alamein, and his health was very much affected. And he was a brilliant, brilliant general, but his health was affected. And Monty was determined to keep fit. And, you know, and so he thought that sleep and not being bothered unnecessarily were all part and parcel of it.
And he was always famous for moderation in his habits.
Very much so. I mean, he didn't drink at all. He didn't mind other people drinking, but he didn't. And he wouldn't have any smoking in his presence. He didn't smoke. He once said to Winston Churchill, "I don't drink, I don't smoke, I'm 100% efficient." And Winston said, "I both drink and smoke, and I'm 105% efficient," he said. It was a great encounter.
Do you think that Montgomery's professional approach to command and the way in which he organised his headquarters and he organised his work and his style had a permanent long-term impact on the way in which British Army commanders have behaved since his time?
Well, they're all different, you see. I can't think of... I mean, the other person you compare him with is Bill Slim. There weren't too many computers out where Bill Slim was. I mean, that really was China graph pencils and a map board. And, you know, sort of sheer personality and willpower. He wouldn't have handled things quite the same way as Monty, but he was a very fine commander. But I do think that Monty has written a pamphlet on higher command, and that has no doubt been incorporated into military thinking. And, you know, he added a principle of war, first win the air battle. So his influence, yes, has been very great on tactics, on command. There's no doubt that there hasn't been anybody quite like him, as I say, since, in my opinion, since Wellington. Alexander was a very nice man. He was a debonair. He was brave. He was much respected, but he didn't have this knowledge of tactics that Montgomery had, and he depended on a very good chief of staff, really. He was a wonderful figurehead, but he was not this man who controlled every aspect of the battlefield that Montgomery was. And that's why I'm sure they made the right decision to put Montgomery in. Of course, Eisenhower wanted Alexander. He was an easy man to deal with. They'd have no trouble from him. But he wouldn't have been as effective.